How are you? What does that mean?
That's just good to see you, man.
Oh, okay. You're ready to curse me out for all the trouble I've been in your life.
Oh, geez. You have no idea.
Now, you've been traveling a lot.
Not really. I mean, no. not since we met in Cali. Yeah, that was something, man. That's I'll gladly do that again. That was so much fun. Like, yeah, let's go hang out at a church classes.
With a bunch of pastors.
I know, right? And they're all nice people too. Who'd have thought? Man. That was weird. I got a story to tell you, man, because that was just weird. I was hanging out at the conference and went to sit down with a guy who is a fellow accessibility developer. And he's fairly left wing, goes to protests, and he's a really good guy. And he says, "So, Job, how long have you been in the US?" And I said, "Well, been here since Wednesday." And this was a Monday. He's like, "Oh, you've been here that long?" I said, yeah, I was hanging out with some pastors. And he says, oh, so you're really religious. So he's like, what's this about? I didn't know you believed. And I said, well, belief is a strong word. I said, I try to relate to the infinite. And then I kind of take the two greatest commandments from the New Testament, plus what Jesus says to his disciples in the end of John, like, after I'm gone, you should love one another. And I said, you can have all sorts of opinions about whether that's true or not, but at least that's what it says, and I can agree with that. So to that degree, that's how I try to work this through. And it's actually the whole story, because I got into this whole mess through this psychologist who really helped my mental state and everything. And he's like, oh, which psychologist? I said, oh, it's Jordan Peterson. And he's like, whoop, 180 degrees. He's like, you, Jordan Peterson? Like, yeah, it's been a huge help. And he's like, really, you? But you work in the same field. You work in accessibility. I'm like, yeah, I mean, think about that, right? Like, maybe your ideas are wrong. This turned into a whole, like, not only did I sort of, in a really weird way, try to explain my faith, whatever that means, but then it turned, not only am I religious to him now, but I'm also a JP nut job. So. This has just been, that was an interesting conference. Yeah, it's been really that's kind of how I wanted to start this convo. So it's gotten really weird. So at some point I woke up and I realized I'd had a dream, and I don't tend to remember my dreams. Sometimes you have a vivid one, you know, and it sticks with you. So I was dreaming that I was in an airplane. I didn't know where I was going in that airplane, and I had lost my passport. Like, how did I get into this plane without my passport? I wouldn't have gotten past security. Like, how does this work? So, you know, that's kind of what I remembered from the dream. And then later in that week, I had a dream where I was riding my bike. I had just flown in somewhere. I was riding my bike, and I was going to go past this bike across this bridge, as I would always do in my dream. And the bridge was open. I couldn't pass. And instead, there was a boat. This bridge is never open. Okay, but there was no room on the boat, so I had to cling to the outside while the boat went to wherever it was going. And again, I realized I'd forgotten my passport. And then I had another dream where I was traveling in a plane or something and didn't have my passport. So, like, that's just, I said to Mallory, it's like, this is weird. I keep having this very similar dream. So I tweeted about it, like, I'm in this weird dream. And a coworker of mine has been studying, he did a study in college, 3 years of Jung and Freud and some Hungarian, I forgot the name, but also one of the psychoanalysts. And he says, okay, so let's go through this. Lie down on the couch. Let's go through. He says, what do you think the plane represents? And I said, well, it's travel one place to another. And he says, okay, so what do you think the passport represents? And I'm thinking, okay, that's identity. And suddenly it hits me like, ah, yeah, I'm doing this stuff and I don't know where I'm going and what I'm becoming. And it's bothering me. And it is. It's really bothering me. Like, I'm not supposed to be religious. Paul, stop it. Help me stop it, man.
Well, I don't know. What does religious mean to you?
Yeah, I don't know. I knew you'd come back with some smart-ass retort.
No, I think everybody's religious. They're just religious about different things.
Yeah. I keep trying to not go to church. And then I ask myself each week, and then I
end up going. A lot of people don't have a hard time not going to church. I have lists of people.
Yeah, but then I debate myself like, well, I should probably go. And then I say, hey, Mallory, should we go to church? And she's like, yeah, of course. I'm like, oh, yeah, probably should. And recently she was arguing that we should go because I wasn't thinking I should go. She's like, yeah. And then she's like, wait, am I arguing that we should go to church? Because she kind of just comes with me. So that's been interesting. So I just ended up sending my pastor a DM, you know, my pastor, saying, yeah, can we have a chat? Because this is just ridiculous. And I explained, you know, this, that I'd been dreaming about this stuff. And I, you know, I talked about the conversations we've been having. And we ended up just having a conversation about similar things. And I said, okay, just to get this straight, pastor, you really believe this, don't you? And he just laughs and he says, well, I am the pastor. I do stand there every Sunday.
One of these lying pastors, but yeah. He lies more than most.
And I said, you know, I understand the value judgment in that question, but I just need to ask it. You know, I need to make sure that I've asked that question. But we just had this whole conversation about, I don't know, books and what is God and what is the resurrection. And he says, the problem for you doesn't seem to be what God is. That doesn't seem to be the issue. The issue is where you are going. And, you know, until you figure that out, you can just keep coming to church and you're welcome. So...
Well, I mean, you go to the grocery store, you can go to church and sit there and listen. I mean, nobody's sticking forks in you or plucking your eyes out or anything.
No,
is it pride? I mean, do you just have pride about not being one of those religious people? Like, you know.
Well, fundamentally, I don't believe. So it's always going to feel really strange.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Because I'm in a building where people come who have, at least to a certain degree, a different belief from what I have.
Well, did you ever go to a sports stadium where it's the home? Let's see. I don't know the sports team.
I'm a computer programmer, Paul. I write code.
If you were a Yankee fan and you went to Fenway Park in Boston, would you feel like somehow, you know, the laws of the universe were being violated?
Well, this metaphor is just totally lost on me.
Fenway Park is where the Boston Red Sox play. Big rivalry against the New York Yankees. So you're in church and you say, well, I'm not on team believing just like everybody in church.
So okay.
I shouldn't be there. It's like the people in church don't care. They're just happy you're there. I mean, and the truth is, I mean, if you were to sit down, if you say sat down with your big list of 20 questions that were, you know, the biggest, hardest questions about Christianity and faith and believing and all that, and you went and you asked people in church, especially if you drew up the list of questions, you'd be surprised at the diversity of the answers in the church.
Probably.
I mean, if you asked things that were in their Heidelberg Catechism lessons, maybe in their youth, you might get the same answers. But if you asked a whole bunch of things that are probably off the top of your head, you know, you might be surprised at the answers you get from people.
I think fundamentally I'm trying to believe, and I think that's the painful part, because you're right. I don't mind going to church. It's fun. I like seeing the people and having conversations, but I don't know. I think that's a good part of it, because I don't think, I mean, the whole pride, shame part, that doesn't seem to be as much there as it was when I started all this. She's like, yeah, I'm going to church. Yeah, okay. So I've been trying to fix it with books. So I started with Tolstoy, which I really liked, because I found that because of Peterson quoting him in Maps of Meaning. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, this guy sounds really familiar and how he reasons through all this stuff. So I read Tolstoy, and he eventually just figures out, you know, I'm just going to go to church, and I don't believe it, but I'm going to go through the ritual, because all these other people, they do it, and it seems to work for them, and, well, maybe I'm wrong. And then as he develops his ideas, it's very interesting. And from Tolstoy, I went into Thomas Nagel. Oh. I tried to understand, I listened to Mind and Cosmos on Audible, and you did a video on it, and I'm going to have to listen to it another time.
Because he's a philosopher, they don't make any sense.
It's really hard to follow, but it's something, I mean, I mean, it is philosophy of mind, and at some point it becomes really abstract and vague.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it is not. I was watching an unbelievable conversation between Luke. Damn it, I forget his name. An apologetics person, Luke something, and Michael Shermer. And I could just hear Esther rolling her eyes over here. But Shermer says, you know, well, probability speaking, there's been about 1 billion people alive, and nobody comes back from the dead. So it's statistically unlikely that could just, oh man. Yeah, Esther, you can DM me. I'm wrong. I know, but you know, I'm trying to work this through. But Thomas Nagel at least approaches it from a less reductionist point of view, as far as I could follow him. I mean, I did like his idea saying, okay, materialism is fundamentally flawed because you can't shine on a flashlight with the flashlight itself. So you have this perspective issue. So I figured, okay, if maybe from Nagel, I didn't understand him very well. I'll fix it. I'll do this metaphysics course on Audible. That only made it worse, Paul. Now I understand even less.
It's just, well, and think about this. I mean, it is kind of funny that you're reading all these highfalutin books, and lots of people who've never read any books at all in their life don't have any trouble believing. So, you know, it isn't the kind of thing that you educate and graduate into. So why do you want to believe so bad?
I don't know, because that's a good question. I don't know. I think fundamentally it helps me at some level. And it'd be really nice if there actually turns out to be some truth to any of this.
Yeah.
I doubt it, but... Yeah, I know.
But you know, everybody's got some of the doubt and some of the belief. Okay. It just sounds like, well, you've lived so much of your life with all this doubt. I mean, it's probably going to take some time for the belief to begin to outweigh the doubt.
So I went through most of David Bentley Hart's The Experience of God, mm-hmm. which is, I mean, I tried to read half, or listen to half of it, but it's similarly extremely hard to follow, especially when he gets into his qualia and events and functional reductionism. In the meantime, while being extremely derogatory towards those poor atheists who just, he likes doing that. That's his style.
That's what he likes.
But so I understand when he defines God as the wellspring of all being, the source from which everything comes, the fundamental basis of whatever, kind of God one in a sense, but mm-hmm. so distant and so vague that it doesn't really matter. Because, like, yeah, something like that could exist and have caused anything, but that would be totally beyond my sorry primate mind to comprehend. So that might as well not exist. It could exist. It doesn't matter. But then there's the God that acts in your life. I would guess that's similar to your definition of God number two. And that comes too close, because that's like, you can't do this, you can't do that, and that part that needs to be snipped off. And so that's kind of the far left versus far right. Where's my enlightened centrist God, you know, that I can...
And well, I like, don't know. Are the people in your church crazy?
I haven't asked them about this stuff.
No.
No.
I'm sure some of them are.
But at that point, it becomes like, yeah, what do you take from that? And what do you... It quickly becomes apologetics from there. Because, I mean, Mallory's been reading the Old Testament, and she figures I might as well start from the beginning. So now, and she's reading it, and she's like, like, what's so funny? She's like, oh, God, in the Old Testament, he's such a prick. I'm like, oh. She's like, and then Moses has to deal with these people. And then God is like, right, I'm tired of them. None of you are going to see the promised land. I'm just going to kill everybody except Moses and start over. And then Moses is like, no, please don't. it's such a different God from the New Testament. And then I know the joke that, well, he chilled out when he became a dad. Like, yeah. But to that point, it becomes so... I know that stuff is very easy to reason against with simple atheism. And I don't really know what the point of any of that is. So, you know, you suggested this book to me, which is Bruce Shelley's Church History.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
I mean, two chapters in, and I didn't even know that the word Christian was kind of a derogatory term that they adopted. I figured that's something they picked.
Nope.
Yeah. And he has this little part in there where he says that the early faith, like after Jesus got crucified, that's pretty much had to be a resurrection faith, because, well, otherwise his disciples would just have figured, well, another failed Messiah, on to the next one, folks. And they wouldn't have been acting like, well, this thing that shouldn't have happened. And yeah, it is a fair argument. Could still all be made up. I don't know. So that line of reasoning isn't getting me anywhere. That's also, I guess, what's frustrating. Like, this is our fourth conversation, and I feel like I've kind of hit.
You feel like you should be done by now. You should be cooked by now.
I should have sort of figured this out. Yeah. I don't know. I expected to have some sort of progress. Like, right, yeah, I've clearly separated the wheat from the chaff.
How do you know you don't have progress?
Oh, geez.
You have a conclusion that you imagine. You have an expectation and a conclusion that you imagine you will arrive at, and it's probably not at all true. I mean, think about when you were a kid and you thought about, I remember being a kid and I was thinking, what will I be like when I'm 35? And as a kid, I had no idea what I would be like when I was 35. I had no idea what life would be like when I was 35. Just got to make it there.
Okay. So what's my next step? Yeah, it's not a fair question. I know it's more of a question to myself.
I think you're doing, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing that your dissonance is driving you to ask hard questions and do good things. And now I'm going to say something terribly Christian to you that might really bother you, but I see this is how God works in people all the time. They have, and in fact, and this might really bother you, sometimes God takes very long time to arrive at what he wants in people so that he can use them for what he wants to do with them. You know, some people say, so I'm 55 years old and I've been pastoring in this church, you know, almost 22 years. And then some people say, well, God has been preparing your whole life for this new online YouTube ministry that you're doing because I have 10,000 subscribers or what have you. So the big numbers impress people. And so all my life I've been reading, and I've been reading books and I've continued to educate myself and I played with technology and all of these things. And all of this is supposed to somehow culminate in my little YouTube channel when I talk about Jordan Peterson. Or we could run it with Jordan Peterson that, you know, Jordan Peterson, had, you know, we watched Jordan Peterson say all these same old things that he did on Ontario Public Television. And it wasn't until C-16 and boom, then suddenly the man met his moment. Well, okay. And I think there's a real validity to that argument, but the argument is told from a perspective that's also a little unreal. And, you know, what I think you keep doing what you're doing. You're doing good things. You know, you yourself talk about how you're much better than you were before. You've made a lot of new friends at church. You and Mallory are having an interesting time reading the Bible and talking about it and exploring it for the first time. Sounds all pretty good to me. You're frustrated because you're expecting a destination. I don't know what that destination looks like. You want the dissonance to go away.
Yes, I need to resolve the chaos into determined order.
Yes. And once you do that, you'll just look for more chaos.
Yeah. And that's very much it. I keep trying to get back to my atheism, and I can't find it anymore. Okay, so...
What do you miss about your atheism?
Well, at least I knew what I had.
See, I think Jordan Peterson would argue you really didn't, because... What he said to poor Sam Harris, that he wasn't really an atheist, which, of course, Sam hated. Matt Dillahunty didn't like it much either.
Yeah, so. Think again, sunshine.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the more I read about that, I'm pretty okay with the Christian agnostic label nowadays. That's as far as I can get.
Well, and pastors are always telling people in church they don't really believe what they say, but they believe. And I think I tell my people that. I tell myself that there are days when I don't believe God near enough because John Calvin in his commentary on the book of Daniel, I think, or maybe it was Joel, I don't know, makes the comment, to the degree that we worry, we doubt God. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, wow. And I see people worry all over the place. And Jesus, in fact, has a command, do not worry. And I tell my church that sometimes, and people look at me like, you're out of your mind telling me not to worry. Well, I didn't make up that command. He made that command. Oh, why shouldn't we worry? Well, because we don't believe that, in fact, God, and we don't believe that God is, in fact, working out his plan, not only for your life, but for this world through you. There's a lot of meaning right there. That God has a plan for Job, and it's happening right now. And Job might not like it. And who named you this name? Good grief. God has a plan for Job. Even saying it is like.
Well, blame my parents. I was supposed to be born on November 11th. Instead, I was born on September 2nd.
Wow.
I couldn't breathe, and I weighed less than 2 pounds. My lungs weren't finished. At least I was quiet. And I had parents with a sense of humor, so they decided to name me Job.
Huh.
That's the story. And thank God for medical technology and incubators, because that sorted it out. So that's why my head has that shape, because back then they wouldn't turn you often enough. So since the head's still soft, it grows that way. one of my eyes was like this, and they fixed that, and this, they fixed this, this fixed that, and I had a brain hemorrhage and didn't destroy enough to kill me. So
wow,
there I am.
Wow,
it works.
Good name for you.
Yeah. Yeah, so I kind of hope I'm at the good part.
Well,
or at least to stay there for a while. So far, I'm doing all right.
I think you are. I mean, you seem to be doing well.
So far. See, I'm going through my list of stuff way too fast. Well, I talk with the pastor about sacrament.
Oh.
Because, of course, the whole Lord's Supper, you know, I told him I can only approach it symbolically. And I'm glad he was honest to me. He says, well, that won't do. Like, you shouldn't participate if you don't accept it. Like, okay, so that fuels my dissonance. Like, okay, so how do I get to that step? Which is, of course, not the right approach, I think. Probably isn't. But, like, at this point, like, okay, so maybe that's a hurdle I won't be able to pass. And then part of me is like, yeah, but you used to think way differently a year ago as well. Okay, fair point. So you're saying don't stop worrying about it and just enjoy the day. Fair enough. Could try that. Haven't tried it yet. So, and why does it bug me that I can't participate in the Lord's Supper? This is ridiculous. I know. Yeah. I know, Paul. It's funny.
It is funny.
It is funny.
I like it.
Like, oh, yeah. You want this ritual so bad? Right. Yeah. Oh, you're happy now that you're baptized, are you? Fuck is wrong with you?
I know. Well, you were baptized as a baby, right?
I was, yes. Yeah. Actually, by a fairly famous pastor, because my pastor was like, oh, when I told him, like, oh, that guy. You're like, yeah, that guy.
Well, see why all this is happening? That's that pastor who baptized you.
I'm sure it's his fault. I'll find where he lives. I'll thank him. So I read this interesting book. So I wanted to talk about me. It's a Dutch book. It's called The Forgotten Gospel, Evangelie. And this guy, he's a very good writer. He basically talks about all these gospels and how Jesus operated. So very much the whole, if somebody tells you to walk with him a mile, walk with him 2 miles. I think that's the quote. And he interprets it in the context of you take the power away from them, because instead of, you don't, not only do you do what they say, you do it more, and then they have to tell you, no, stop walking, only 1 mile. And I thought that was interesting. There's a bunch of more examples in the book where he explains, well, it's all about taking agency away, similarly to how the crucifixion, in a sense, took agency away from death. And the entire book culminates to his views on the Christ victor approach instead of salvation through, I don't know the English
substitution,
word.
There's substitutionary, there are these different atonement theories. One is Christus victor, which is basically God the conqueror, Jesus the conqueror. And the other is substitutionary atonement, where Jesus is the sacrifice.
Right. What are your views on that?
I think that what's clear from the Bible is that what Christ effected for us on the cross fundamentally changes us and the world. I think we, and then the Bible actually gives us a variety of images that we develop into these atonement theories. And I think they're mutually valid. They're different perspectives on the event. I mean, can we don't understand a lot about reality. How are we really going to understand the redemption of reality when we struggle to understand reality itself? So I think these atonement theories are helpful ways for us to image what God has done for us. And I don't think so. There are actually books on this where they lay out the different atonement theories. And one of the theories is similar to what I'm saying, in that God wrought what we call salvation for us. These are different theories that try to illuminate it. And, you know, it's kind of like wave versus particle in terms of light. So I don't see why we have to choose. And I think the Bible doesn't make us choose. The Bible, you know, Paul talks about, you know, Jesus, you know, conquering the principalities and the powers at the cross. That's very much Christus Victor. And the Gospel of John talks about the Lamb that was slain, or John the Baptist, behold the Lamb of God. That's very much the substitutionary atonement. The Bible seems to be comfortable with all of those images. In fact, the Bible mostly gives us images that we finish. And that's even true of something important like the doctrine of the Trinity. You don't find the doctrine of the Trinity laid out in the Bible as such. As theologians have said, the doctrine of the Trinity is in the Bible in solution. The elements are there, and later church councils, you know, articulate them. But, you know, even so, we continue to struggle to articulate the Trinity now. So I don't have a problem with that. When I talk to you about these things, you are generating ideas and concepts and constructs in your mind in an attempt to try to reconstruct what maybe I have in my mind. Those two copies won't be identical, but they'll probably be close enough that we can continue to talk. So the heart of atonement is God rescues us from ourselves. God rescues us from the world. God rescues us from the evil principality that we call Satan or the devil, and that entire category. How does God do that? Does he conquer them? Yes. Does he conquer them by being the Lamb that was slain? Yes. Well, you say, well, there are tensions between those two images. Well, sure, there's always tensions between images. That doesn't bother me. So I don't have a problem with multiple atonement theories.
Okay. No, I just, it was new to me. I'd never really thought about it.
Well, my friend, the dissonance isn't going to go away, because the more you get into this stuff, the more, I mean, just like you've had this experience of, oh, there's different atonement theories. I thought I was understanding Christianity. I read the Heidelberg Catechism and you have this substitutionary atonement. And then over here, I see this Christus Victor way. And actually, Jordan Peterson, you listen to him, you have the Jesus is the example. But that tended to be a little bit more Pelagian in terms of we have to live up to this. But that theme is also in the New Testament. So the New Testament isn't giving you propaganda. The New Testament is laying out a complex reality that the truth is, the more you go into this, the greater complexity you'll likely find, which is actually a good thing, because you're probably not, I mean, Jordan Peterson says it when he says, the deeper I go into Bible stories, they just keep looking, you know, you think you're going to find the bottom, and oh, the bottom isn't here, it's further still. Well, that's sort of the way this goes with theology too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably what's going to happen.
I mean, you can play checkers and at some point, or you can play tic-tac-toe, and at some point, tic-tac-toe is no longer fun to play because everybody understands that when you were four or five, well, it was a grand mystery who won. Well, then you pretty much realize that nobody's going to win because you're both paying attention enough that there's no victor in tic-tac-toe. Then you go to checkers, and that's a little bit more mysterious, but then someone masters checkers. And then you go to chess, and we haven't gotten to the bottom of chess yet, or maybe we have. So, I mean, and those are simple games on simple boards. And when you're talking about what Jesus has affected in terms of humanity's story, and you get to the point at which in the beginning in Colossians 1, Jesus is the first fruit of, you know, the resurrection, and he's the image of the invisible God. Well, you're a good bit further than chess at that point, because there are a lot of moving parts. And that's
still Paul, right?
Yeah. And then you've got Paul, and you've got John, you know, both in the New Testament. You got James in there, and you've got Matthew and Mark. So there's a lot going on. And then, you know, just this morning, I was thinking about, you know, so Christianity imagines that in our redemption, we will this existence that I understand myself as Paul Vanderclay, this will somehow be translated into the age to come. And then I look, then I watch people and how they don't get along. And I watch how they don't get along, sometimes for sinful reasons, sometimes just for interesting personality quirks. And I think, well, how's God going to work that out in the age to come? And will we get bored in the age to come because there isn't enough chaos to keep us interested? And maybe chaos is the wrong thing. You know, and so I start thinking about questions like that, and I will never answer these questions as long as I live. And I can speculate on them, but and then sometimes thoughts will come into my head, well, maybe this is all incoherent, and you know, maybe I'm just making this up. And then you'll get the doubts of the materialists. Well, maybe I'm just this highly evolved ape that has a big enough brain to worry about things, but I'm in a context now where I have amazing food security. And I mean, you can play these games all day in your head. And so then I deal with those kinds of ideas. So you live with, and then you live with these kinds of things, and you think about it for a while, and you say, well, you know, and then you run through all the arguments that you have, and I'm just always thinking about these things. And then someone would say, well, Paul, so you can talk to people about this stuff because you have thought of these things, and you do wrestle with doubts and questions. And yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. So why, Lord, don't you banish the doubts from my mind? Well, maybe the doubts are helpful for what God wants to do with me. Maybe the doubts that I have to wrestle with are helpful for Job. So when you go to bed tonight, you say, thank you, Lord, for the doubts you put in Paul Vanderclay's head so we can have nice conversations together. I say, Job, don't thank him for that. I wish I'd be done with them. But, you know, we're not masters of any of this.
Yeah, my prayers aren't that complex either. But no, we're not masters of any of this, especially when I read Hart and Nagel and metaphysics, and like, you know what? I'm going to pull weeds in the garden. That's what I'm going to do. Because at least that's then, there's no dissonance there, you know, like, okay.
Weed, pull. That's right. Simple. But then, then you think about the... You think about the amazing thing that dirt is, and how there are nutrients in the soil, and plants grow, and you know, it's just creation is. This world is an amazing, amazing place.
Oh yeah, I could feel extremely thankful just having my little garden plot and just kind of, you know, putting around there, not trying to think about programming, and But that's also something this whole religion thing kind of did. It shows that more to a degree of, I'm not sure if I'm making it up or... I've been experimenting to see to which degree my diet has been an influence. So what I did, I had a relapse recently where I had a couple of bad days and I figured, what's wrong? Okay, I'm going to fast for 2 days. I was going to fast for a week and reset. So I fasted for 2 days, feeling really hungry. And then the next morning, my fire pager goes off. Like, oh no. My energy levels were just shit. And right. So, I mean, we cleared the fire, but I wasn't my usual shape. Like, okay, I gotta go eat. And I figured I might as well use that as an experiment to see what happens. So I cooked Indonesian food. I make, you know, all the stuff I'm not supposed to have, like rice and peanut sauce, and I had a beer with it. And, you know, all the stuff I've given up for about a year. And I ate it for 3 days. And I measured my blood ketones and my glucose levels. And sure as hell, you know, start hating myself, start worrying about death. Like, oh, so that stuff was all still there. That was never really gone. It was just somewhere else. And that's been interesting. So, which then, of course, also makes you mind like, oh, well, if it's just diet, I could probably do away with all this religion stuff.
That's right. If I ate right, I wouldn't need God.
Right. it's so obvious. It's. but you like church. You might as well keep going. Yeah. I realized that as I was talking to my pastor. Oh, I'm just being very slowly pushed into a direction. And like, no. Trying to walk back. And because it's not like I'm not aware of it. Like I'm very, 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 very slowly. And I mean, my subconscious is very aware of it. But yeah. This is very similar to the second conversation we had where I was like, yeah, but it's all good, isn't it? Yeah, to a degree. So, I don't know. I just like to yak with you, Paul. That's.
I like yakking with you too, Job. It's fine. And if we live next door to each other, we could, you know, pull weeds and sit and yak. And
yeah.
Although in the Netherlands, we'd be very close because you've got such a small country. So we came to America to get a little elbow room here.
Yeah, when I sent you the photo of the Sacramento road sign, yeah, we're close. I've been having some nice mail conversations with at least someone I met at the meetup. So that's been interesting. There was a girl there, Paula.
And oh yeah, she, yeah.
And we've been kind of mailing back and forth. She's been reading. Camille Paglia, and she's very enthusiastic about her, so that's interesting. I'm meeting with Jeff next week in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to meet up in Austin.
Oh, fun.
I'm there for a conference, yeah.
Okay. I hear Austin's a great city.
Everybody's been telling me to go to something called the Salt Lick, which apparently is some barbecue place.
Come on, you have cows in the Netherlands. You know what a salt lick is.
Yeah, but like people are like, go to the salt lick. So I looked it up and it's just have you seen the meat pit? And it's this huge grill thing. Like, oh yeah, Texas. I've heard you shouldn't mess with it. Okay. And let's see. Then from Austin, I go to Toronto to speak. And so I tried to see if I could meet up with Nolan. But he lives all the way in Alberta.
Yeah. So Toronto and Alberta are not close.
Yeah.
There is, if you're in Toronto, there is a church, Knox Church. It's right by University of Toronto. The pastor of that church is named Phil Reinders.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, another Dutchman. And a Canadian Dutchman. So I would imagine his parents were probably immigrants. So he is the pastor of Knox Church in Toronto, and he sat in front of me for New Testament for Greek in college, and then we went through seminary together. He's a terrific guy. So if you're on a Sunday, see if you can see Phil Reinders. He's a good guy. I guess I've heard that Knox Church is right next door to the University of Toronto. So of course you can't find Jordan Peterson there, but
no, I did. I was in Toronto last year and I did go check it out, but I'm not going to be in Toronto on the Sunday. I'm flying home, so that's probably going to work out. And in Texas, I was hoping to see if I could hit the Orthodox Church.
Oh yeah, Father Lewis.
Lewis, yeah, but it's like Texas also quite big. So
yes. Yeah. Even well, you're going to Austin. Yeah, Texas. Everything. I mean, I don't know how far away Dallas is from Austin, but it could be a very long ways.
Seemed at least an hour away.
Yeah, that would be small for Texas. Like in California, I mean, we're hour and a half, 2 hours from San Francisco, and, you know, 6 to 8 hours from Los Angeles, and 10 hours from San Diego. I mean, it's big, big country.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, why do people have countries that big? Like, you start with a small country. If you need more land, you take it from the sea. That's how that works.
Yeah. I don't know. I really wish I knew why my great-great-grandfather sent my great-grandfather over to Western Michigan. I don't know why they did that. I think they got that falling out.
Yeah, Mallory says that the Dutch went to Michigan because it reminded them of the Netherlands.
Yeah, well, and the land was cheap and nobody else wanted it and all of those reasons.
Yeah, if I'm ever going to be in Grand Rapids again, which is probably going to be next year or the year after to visit the in-laws, I'm going to see if I can meet some of the folks of the CRC. See if we can meet up somewhere.
Well, there's a meetup that has started in Grand Rapids, and some of the people that have been in my channel are going there. Len Vanderzee has been there, and so there is a meetup, and I've been encouraging them. So I wish, you know, if I had, I shouldn't say I wish I didn't have a day job, because sometimes that happens. Unemployment is lovely except for the money, but it would be so much fun to visit all these meetups and, you know, go hang out with the Grand Rapids meetup, and of course John Van Donk's meetup in Southern California, and I want to help some other people north of here start some meetups. So it's just too much fun, and and you got a sense of it. I mean, I think you probably had a good time at our meetup, although you were terribly jet lagged. But
it was lovely. It was great to see so many people just have balanced conversations, and you know, there were disagreements, but it went so well that we're like, oh, we're going to crash John Van Donk's house. You know, just, hey, John, I know you have this bottle of whiskey. Where is it? That was great. It all worked out really well. That was, and John is a master schemer. He just does. And we had the second meetup where only a few people showed up. But then, you know, John just sits there, he listens. And then when he needs to say something, he does.
Yeah.
And he just nudges. Yeah. And yeah, that's a skill.
Yeah. Yeah. He's really good at it. He's really good at it. So John is so much fun. John is so much fun. I wish I lived closer, but that's,
yeah. Yeah.
That is the way it is.
Yeah. And you know, that whole road trip he did, he just amazing guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was really good to get to know him.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're running low on time here. Let's see, anything else I had? If you're ever going to get a chance, this is that book that Peterson talks about, The Fruit, the Tree, and the Serpent, about snake detection theory. It's very interesting if you like primate evolution.
Huh. Is it a technical book, or is it fairly straightforward to read?
No, it's got lots of, I mean, you got to like reading papers. I wouldn't say it's popular science at its base level, because it assumes a certain amount of knowledge, but it's a very good book, and it kind of builds around all her studies that she did in that field, and she talks about how at first her findings were seen as controversial, and nowadays they seem to be more accepted.
See, and even that is, I mean, when you think about this pretense that we have about our mastery of this world, you know, if you read Thomas Kuhn's History of Scientific Revolutions, it's a really funny thing how deeply dependent we are upon the community around us to see reality. I mean, we know this from culture. Different cultures see reality in dramatically different ways. Yet in the West, we have this idea that here I am in my little rational mind, and I'm going to be the judge of what is and what is not, and what should and what should not be. When, well, okay, well, let's step back and pay attention to the fact that we believe in groups and in herds. And I love how people say blithely, well, you would be a Muslim if you grew up in a Muslim country. And I say, well, you wouldn't think I would be a Muslim in a Muslim country if you didn't grow up in America. Because it's how we think. And so you can have a scientific theory, and at first everybody's skeptical and it's controversial, and pretty soon everybody believes it, and then it's dogma. Then someone comes up with a new theory, and, oh, we can't believe that new theory. We've all agreed on our old theory, but the person with the new theory is really kind of cool, and there's some aspects about that that I really like. So, you know, 30 years later, we all believe the new theory, and we all think, well, we're masters of the universe. We're pretty flaky masters.
We try to be. I mean, I remember when the aquatic ape theory was pretty popular back in the 90s, I think that was, maybe even older.
Yeah.
But, you know, that it had, there were some points to it. But yeah, we have no idea how the brain works. Not at all. We have, I mean, I do see interesting things. Like recently there was this research where they had these electrodes and they could translate brain signals into computer speech. Like really pretty accurate. And that's scientifically amazing, absolutely amazing. But it gives you this false sense of, now that we can do this, now we can map these mental states to brain states, that means that works generically, and we can soon map thoughts to imagery. And that doesn't seem to be the same level of complexity.
And you still have the problem of us watching us. So if I'm sitting there in a computer and I think something and I hear the computer say something, then I think, I wonder what else I can get the computer to say. Yeah. So now I'm, you know, I'm colonizing the process.
I can hear C.S. Lewis in the back of my head.
I mean, we keep doing this to ourselves. And don't we stop and recognize what we're doing to ourselves? And we do it all the time. We're
from
just
my
the
last
piano keys. So then we smash the piano.
for my last birthday, Mallory bought me a t-shirt. And it says, you're a half crazy primate and you're full of snakes. And what the hell do you know anyway? And it's a Peterson quote. It's like, it's so dead on. We're just these neurotic creatures. And we don't understand why we're going to church, but we want anyway.
And all of that, and the fact that, you know, when your parents had you when you were premature, everything that everyone went through just to save you, and to nobody said, you can have another baby, let this one die. I mean, there are many places in the world and ages in the world where, you know, if you were born a girl in the Roman Empire and the paterfamilias said, we don't need another girl, throw it out on the garbage heap. You know, and why on earth would we as a culture say, well, that would be wrong to kill Job because he was premature. We have to fight for his life.
Yeah, I don't know. They did. I mean, there were pretty strong concerns about that I'd be that have cerebral palsy and oxygen deprivation and this, this, and that. And yeah. I don't know. That's a really, that's a hard conversation to have in the two remaining minutes.
Yeah.
I thank you for, giving me another hour of your day.
It's really nice fun to hear from you again and to check in and to see what you're thinking about. And, you know, and I think there are worse. So I had Sunday school this week and so Lily had brought Joanne in and we were talking about evangelism and testimony and Joanne said, yeah, Miss Lily's a little older than Joanne. They're both women up in their years. And she said, yeah, Lily said to me, you know, every Sunday morning I go to Sunday school and I really like it. So you have nothing better to do on Sunday morning. Just try it. And if you like it, you can come back. That's all she said. And Joanne's been in class for, you know, 3-4 years. And, you know, what better do you have to spend on Sunday morning? And I think you've been on a wonderful adventure, and it will be interesting to see where all this adventure goes.
You're the second person to tell me that.
Who was the first?
Yeah. Esther. Oh. In similar words.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Paul, thanks again. And have a great remaining day. It's 2 a.m. here. I gotta go to bed.
Yes, you do have to go to bed. Yeah. All right. Good night, Joe.
Take care, Paul. Bye-bye. All right.
Bye-bye.